Hello out there. My name is Tina with Tutti Sweet Delectable Desserts. I'm the owner and operator of a dessert catering company in the Metro Atlanta area.
At the slideshow, let's talk about the four-year-old cake with the popcorn all around it.
That is
an awesome cake.
That was for a special little boy, and his mother is actually a surprise for him. She was going to set the whole party up like a carnival. You know, there's going to be, you know, little tent and all kind of fun stuff for him to do. And I really wanted to capture the spirit of a carnival on a cake. And the elements are all there. You have, you know, when you think carnival, you think, you know, sweets and popcorn and just lots of color and clowns and, you know, just fun and festive type things that happen at a carnival. So that led me to do the little buckets of popcorn, which were cupcakes.
Wonderful.
And to do, and to just really just bring the cake up into the spirit of, you know, being at a carnival. I even put gumballs, the trim around the cake, are large pieces of gum, candy gumballs. And so there was a lot of edible. The cake was all edible with the exception of the paper around the cupcake. Everything was
incredible.
Edible on there.
How long did it take you to make that cake and you know, what was the timeline or time frame she gave you when she ordered it, if you remember?
She ordered it, and I always tell people this, for something like that, order when you know you're having the party, but she let me know a week in advance. In this business, you have to think on your feet because you got to think people are shopping. So
right.
I when somebody gives me that, I have a concept usually within an hour or so.
Okay. We have callers on the line. Let me just see if this...
Buzzle, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
This is actually Fred Opie.
Doctor?
Yes.
Introduce yourself quickly, Professor.
Well, Leslie, since we actually last talked, I'm actually in Massachusetts now working at Babson College. And I saw you were having a show that you wanted me to participate, so I called in. But for the audience, I do publishing, and I have a blog that deals with food and food history. So I actually was really interested in what your guest had to say, and I've done a little research on particularly cakes and cake history, so I'm very interested in what your guest has to say.
Wonderful. We're going to go through the slideshow about four or five more cakes, and I'm going to bring you right back in.
Sounds good.
Bring in the Black history concept, but thank you, Professor.
Okay.
Hold on one second.
Well, I can certainly use some sweet potato pie considering the last 10 minutes of my day, but this is R. Lee Gordon, and I apologize for being late to the show.
Okay.
Hi, Mr.
Gordon.
Hello, Tina. I apologize. I apparently blew a fuse and didn't realize it until my laptop shut off, and so I just had to replace that, and now I'm back up and running.
Wonderful.
Okay, I'm going to let you take over the show, and because you were late, we're going to extend the show for another half hour or so. Is that okay with the two of you?
Sure. I love talking about the sweet life, and I'm really excited to have Tina on. I don't know what you guys covered, but I guess for my own benefit, if no one else's, I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you do and why you do it.
Well, I do it simply for the passion of it all.
Uh-huh.
I am a dessert caterer, of course, you know that, Mr. Gordon. And I've been baking, you know, on my own since I was, you know, 11. I got my first mixer at 11, but I grew up with grandmothers that were excellent bakers, and that just drove my passion and interest to do what I'm doing today. You know, and not to mention I love sweets. I love sweets. I've always been a dessert person. So, you know, the care and time that I put into making sure that my desserts are the best, you know, I appreciate them first before I have anyone else too. So.
Well, let me ask you this, Tina. Are these family recipes that have been passed down through your grandmothers and your ancestors and still coming to life every time you mix them up in a bowl and pop them in an oven?
there are a few on my menu. T.T. Jean's carrot cake is a pass down. Effie's vanilla cream pound is a pass down. And there are some others. The red velvet is a modification of my grandmother. So,
wonderful.
Yeah.
And who are some of your best customers?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, it's kind of like a mom. You don't have any favorites. You don't have any favorites. I love them all. I do, because they've been supportive through all these, for the last 4 years. You know, I've grown, but, you know, when I can still talk to the first person that bought the first cake that I ever made, you know, that's a testament.
That is a testament, and that speaks to the power and flavor, if you will, of customer service. And I applaud you for keeping it foremost, because obviously that's critically important.
Yes, sir, it is. And service, you know, cake, a good cake at that, is not something exclusive to Tutti Sweet. There are several bakeries and organizations or restaurants that provide good cake, but you know, my service is personalized. I was speaking with Leslie about concept, you know, the concept, how fast I come up with concepts for cake. It's because I try and know my customers and get a feel for what they want. And I want the cake to be as personal and as much to their taste as possible. So the service, it's paramount to provide that, because I'm not offering anything that anyone else can't give them. It has my touch on it, so that's what makes it special.
Really? Let's talk a little bit about the hairdresser.
Okay.
Tina?
I didn't hear.
Let's talk about the hairdresser. According to Leslie, this was a conversation you guys were engaged in already, or a part of the business or something?
Oh, the blow dryer cake. Is that what you're talking about, Leslie? Hello?
Let's assume so.
Yes, let's run with it. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Hair dryer.
That was the first sculpted cake I ever did. It was for a hairstylist. And I had to come up with something, you know, for her. And that's what it turned out to be. I can't even tell you, that was the very first sculpted cake I did. And it was for her hairstylist that I didn't know personally, but someone was ordering it for her. And then that's
so,
how it
Yep. Tina, let's talk a little bit how you got in. Obviously, baking has always been a passion of yours. You started out about 4 or so years ago, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
As a business, yes.
As a business, but I'm sure you've been making cake for your family and friends, for most of your adult life, correct?
Right.
And you said you also still remember your favorite customer. What was your first sale as a business owner? What was your first sale?
If you can believe it, it was cookies and red velvet cake.
I can believe the red velvet cake, because that's probably one of my all-time favorites.
And cookies.
And cookies.
She asked for cookies, and then she asked for cake.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would like to think that because of your great quality of baked goods and your great customer service, that you do a lot of repeat and referral business. Is that correct?
Yes. Even in this economic climate, you know, I'm really, really pleased. I do get a lot of referrals, and I do repeat business. I just made a cake for a little boy. He is now 6. I've been making his cake since he was 2 years old.
Wow. And so you do birthday cakes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's so funny. My wife loves the they show all the different businesses who make typically wedding cakes. Have you ever watched that show?
I'm a Food Network junkie, and now that TLC has gotten in on it, yes, I watch several hours of those shows when I have the chance.
Do you get any ideas from them? Do you learn anything from them?
Oh, mostly inspiration. I mean, because you see, it's always nice to see that America or your community or people out there are seeing what it takes for you to get this stuff to the table.
Right. Right.
It adds value to what I do. It does, because people see all the hard work that goes into doing this stuff.
Right, right.
So,
and so you're a little bit more appreciated in terms of the wonderful products that you put out.
Exactly.
Now, what is your most popular seller? What's your best-selling item? If you had to pick one, is it the red velvet cake? Is it cookies?
It is the red velvet cake. The red velvet cake, and the pound cake is coming up to be a close second. But the red velvet cake, it has been all these years, bar none, no exception, the top seller.
Now, is that because, now you're out of the Atlanta market?
Right. I'm in the South, so that helps it along.
Right, right, because I know back in Detroit, which is 85% African-American, red velvet cake was a hit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I'm figuring because you're in Atlanta, which is predominantly African-American as well, red velvet cake. Now, what about sweet potato pie? I mean, that's one of my favorites. Do you mean sweet potato pie, Tina?
That was on my menu when I first started.
Uh-huh.
But I took it off because, believe it or not, it was not a really big seller.
Really?
And only because in our family, what I was finding was that you had so many aunts and grandmoms and sisters. They turned so many of these things out around the holidays. You know, if people buy a sweet potato cake, they're just going to grab it. Sweet potato pie, they're going to grab it from the grocery store, or somebody in the family's already making one. So it wasn't selling enough for me to keep it on the menu. The sweet potato pound cake, however, is a seller. Sweet potato pound cake is a seller.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'm looking at the slides. Just for our listeners, they have to check out your... the beautiful products, the beautiful cakes, colorful, elegant, and they run the gamut, everything from, as you suggested, a birthday cake with a hair dryer design on it, to children's birthday cakes, to these very elaborate and elegant wedding cakes. And I'm sure you have some stories that you'd like to share with our listeners, Tina, about the kitchen disasters. Or, you know, some funny story in terms of getting that product done, especially when you do these very elaborate ones. Do you have any horror stories or do you have any humorous stories you'd like to share with our listeners in terms of getting the cake to a customer or anything like that?
First cooking disaster was my first wedding cake. And I need to see if that's on the slideshow. My first wedding cake was my first real kitchen disaster. I don't know if I see it on here. But, geez. Oh, there it is. The three cakes with the pink roses and the cakes on floating tiers. One on the bottom, one kind of midway, and one at the top with the roses.
Uh-huh.
That was my first cake disaster.
That's beautiful.
And my customer never knew it.
Wow. And that's really... Those are the best stories, basically the untold ones, right? The ones that people don't know about, right? And I'm actually impressed that it was your first one because I'm sure that you haven't had any since then.
As much as I know about baking, that wedding cake was made three times in a 24-hour period. When
wow.
I got there, I tried to be poised. But I was just falling apart inside because I was delirious from lack of sleep. But it was just one tier of this cake, and it was, ironically enough, the red velvet cake that kept falling. And it kept falling. I could not, for the life of me, figure out what was going on. And it was just a simple, you know, it was my first year doing this professionally, and I didn't understand that, you know, there's a certain volume that, and this is a dense cake, so, you know, the certain volume that the pan can take before it will not cook all the way through. So I had to take my lumps on that one. You know, it was just a very, very simple thing is to not putting so much batter in the pan But it was a very, very, very tough lesson to learn at the last minute because her wedding was the next day. So
yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well,
it turned
again,
out beautifully, though.
Right, and again, the customer never knew, which is, you know, the most important thing.
Right. I had to keep shaking it until I got it right.
I hear you. Well, we learn, the best of us learn from experience. Now, I just want to let our listeners know that if they were to take a look at the slideshow, they have to go to blogtalkradio.com. Well, let's give them your website. Do you have a website?
I do.
Let's share with, share with our listeners, if you will, your website address.
Sure, it's www.toothissweet.biz, and that's T like Tom, O, U, T like Tom, D like David, E, S, W, E, E, T like Tom, dot, B for Bravo, I for ice cream, and Z like zebra. So that is my website.
Okay, and I thought toot was a French word. It looks French to me. Tell our listeners what that means.
It is very French.
See, that was right.
I took several years of French in high school and college. And in French, when you say, you know, you want something toot sweet, that means right away. And so I just took, you know, that and kind of just mixed it up and just toot also means all of.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to the sweet means all of the sweet. So I kind of just twisted up a French saying to make my company.
Now, in terms of your client base, is it basically more of a business-to-consumer market, or do you do corporate events?
I have done both, but the majority is corporate is maybe 2%. All the rest are consumers.
Okay. Well, we have a special guest, I think, on the line. This is Professor Opie, Fred Doug, and he wrote a book on the history of African-American foods. Professor, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And first thing I want to know, where did red velvet cake come from?
You got me on that. You got me on that one. Where it came
from? Really?
Yeah, you got me on that one. You know, it's funny when it comes to food history, there are a lot of things that I actually learn when I listen to shows like this, or when I'm out doing book events and we do Q&A from the audience, and people ask me questions, and I'll be like, I'm not a person to spin. If I don't know, I'll tell you, I don't know. And it's often when I'm honest like that, somebody in the audience will know the answer, but I'm sure there'll be a caller coming with the answer. I don't know where it started, but I know it's become a tradition within, you know, the African-American community. And it is very much rooted in the South. You know, my first job was at Morehouse College in Atlanta, so I lived there, and I know you know what you're talking about. But I'm not sure. I do know, you know, kind of one of the interesting things that may add to the conversation is that historically, particularly black women and women in Africa, the selling of food as street vendors and market vendors has always been a way for people of African descent to make money. And when people came to the Americas as enslaved folks, you see this from Brazil to, you know, different parts of the South, that women particularly sold food and sweets, very often sweets, as a way of gaining their manumission and their freedom, not only for themselves, but for their loved ones.
Very interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about sweet potato pie, because that's sort of right next to my love of red velvet cake, and probably doesn't have as much of the food coloring in it. So I'm going to put it out there to both of you. Let's talk about, you know, where sweet potato pie originated, if you have any information you can share with our listeners. Professor?
That one I could share some light on. What's interesting is that if you look at African culture, West Africa, where most of our ancestors came from, were cultures that were rooted around yams, and yam culture was very important. If you read the book Things Fall Apart, you'll see that talked about quite a bit. But one of the things is that there's a difference. There's the yam, and there's many varieties of yams. Some of them come from Asia, but most of them from Africa. And then there's sweet potato. Sweet potato is actually an American crop. and that's something that people don't often realize. But when enslaved Africans came to the New World, they do like anybody. Like, I just moved to Boston, so one of the first things I'm doing when I go out shopping is looking for some of the staples I use when I cook. And I'm not in New York where I had access to different things, but our ancestors did the same thing. So when they came to the New World, many of them had yams, but also many of them incorporated sweet potatoes that were around them and indigenous people were using. Now, so that's one thing, that you have this yam culture. One thing that you didn't see before people came to the Americas as enslaved people, even free people, is pies. Pies didn't exist in African culture, but they did exist in European culture, particularly in British culture. So as British planters came to the New World and they had enslaved Africans, you had these two cultures coming together. You had the yam culture, and Africans would make puddings and different type of things, fufu particularly, and then you had the Europeans who wanted these pies. So Africans who were the cooks for these enslaved, for these Europeans, particularly British masters, came together and began to make the sweet potato pie. So that's how you see these things coming together, these two cultures coming together.
And again, I would suspect that that was a fairly popular crop in the South throughout slavery, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, sweet potatoes and yams were both given out in some areas of the South as rations. And early on, they were considered poor people's food. So the sweet potato and the yam that the Africans either made for themselves or made in their own gardens, or sometimes were just given out as rations.
Right. And let's get back to Tina, because Tina, being the culinary delight that she is, has actually evolved sweet potato pie into what, a sweet potato pound cake? Is that correct, Ms. Wimby?
Yes.
And tell us, and that apparently is very popular as well with a lot of your customers?
Oh, yes, it has been. I introduced it earlier, around the end of last year, early this year, and it is consistently a hit. And I think because all of us grew up, especially here in the South, and I'm sure everywhere else, we grew up with the sweet potato pie taste.
That's right. That's right. That's a staple.
We grew up with that. And so, mm-hmm. you know, this cake has really, really become a comfort food. You know, it's just as much so as the pie has. So, you know, it's going to be really big around the holidays, naturally, because that's when we look for those flavors.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, they're just ingrained in our ancestry and our heritage and our history. Now, let me ask you this. Do you grow your own sweet potatoes? Do you use organic sweet potatoes? Do you use a local farmer in your community or in your area?
I do go to farmer's market for mm-hmm. something, but I wish I could grow them. I have a black thumb. I can't grow anything.
Well, you were thinking of a place like Atlanta, where there still are a lot of black farms, or at least in the outskirts of Atlanta. we have to hook you up with a local producer, you know.
Yeah, because I love fresh fruit and vegetables. I have friends and customers that grow things, and it amazes me just so much as it amazes them that I can bake, you know. But I can't grow a thing, but I will keep a farmer in business if I know one.
Okay, well, we're going to put the shout out if there's any farmers out there who do a mean organic sweet potato. Sweet potato is such a hard...
Strawberries,
you know what?
Peaches, everything, because I make a lot of fruit-based desserts.
Right. And, Professor, I would suspect that sweet potato, again, is such a hearty staple that you really can't not grow it, right? It's almost like when I dropped some comfrey seeds in the backyard the next day, there was comfrey in my neighbor's yard.
Exactly. And it was one of those plants that also was introduced to Africa as part of the African slave trade. And it was just one of those plants that was really hardy. You know, it's interesting you talked about the sweet potato pound cake. And the reason why we call it pound cakes is because the original recipes that did come from Europe called for a pound of sugar, a pound of butter, a pound of flour. That's where the term came from.
Wow.
And that's exactly what I do.
don't be giving your recipes away, Tina. That's proprietary information.
You
okay?
Know, there's nothing new under the sun. But yeah, you know, you need a pound of something and a pound of something and a pound of something to make a true pound cake.
Yeah,
right. And you know, one of the things I would like to ask Tina is, do you see more and more people requesting organic or being more concerned with the amount of sugar or the calories in a more health-conscious modern society than you may have a few years ago?
Oh, I am so glad you brought that up. The new thing is gluten-free.
Yeah.
And sugar-free. I got so many customers that I'm going to have to start working on before Thanksgiving that are diabetic. Now, I can't do gluten-free. That's something that I'm not going to delve into. I actually have a fellow baker friend that does the gluten-free, and I always refer those customers to them, but I have to start making sugar-free desserts.
Yeah.
Because so many of us, as African-Americans, we suffer with diabetes. It
right.
is sad, and I see more and more of it every year where it's creating a demand for me.
Right.
I'm going to have to do it.
Right. And Professor, are there, I know sweet potato, for instance, while it's sweet, doesn't necessarily need to consist of a lot of sugar because it's sweet. Are there any other recipes, baked goods that you're aware of, Professor, that that would also, you know, be healthier options?
You know, I would probably refer you over to, there's a book called The Soul Vegetarian that may have some information in that. And there are a number of websites that people have developed and even books published for, you know, that talk about, you know, cooking for diabetes, you know, people with diabetes and things like that. But there's certainly, you know, Tina, I would say that would be a niche where you could do a bang up business. You're right. I mean, there's a huge demand for it, and if you develop that part of your company, you probably end up having to hire a whole lot of people just to keep up with the market demand.
Yeah, that's true. It'd certainly be an interesting niche that's becoming a lot more prevalent in our consciousness. Professor, what's the name of your book? I'm sure that, you know, and I'd like you to share a little bit about it if Tina doesn't mind. Just give us a quick overview of your book because, you know, we've enjoyed you participating in the show and we certainly like to help promote sales of your book.
And the book is called Hog and Hominy, Soul Food from Africa to America. And what I did in the book is it started out as a lecture that I gave in 2004 at an African-American church, and the lecture was about black men's health. And I, at that time, was just finishing my doctorate degree in history. And asked the medical doctor that was running this, I said, look, I'd like to participate. He said, well, what do you want to do? I said, how about I give a historical context to what we eat and why we eat? And soul food is, you know, when you think about black folks, that's our thing. So he said, sure. And I just did some basic research to find out what was going on, and I quickly learned that there really wasn't a lot of scholarship on it. There were some cookbooks, and then you had people who were cooks that would write a little about the history. But there wasn't a lot of documentation. So I did the lecture. It was well received. And I just started, at that point, doing the extensive research and making it into a book. So the book starts out in West and Central Africa. And then I take the story of what we eat as African Americans up throughout the history from 14th, 15th century West and Central Africa all the way up until the late 1960s and the term soul food, which never even appears in any documented history until around 68, so it's associated with the Black Power movement. So I talk about the term is very much associated with the Black Power movement. So what I do in the book is talk about why we eat what we eat. When did our eating become a little bit more hazardous to our health, and how those changes happen, both politically and historically. And then my theme throughout the book is I don't hit people over the head, but the message is this is what we ate that was healthy. This is when it became unhealthy. Here's the modifications that you can make to make your food healthy. And I interviewed about something like 30 people who were over the age. My target group was people over the age of 60, 65 that either were born in the South or like my grandparents, or, you know, like my mother and father had parents who were born in the South. So I wanted to see how things would change. So I talk about the African slave trade. I talk about the colonial period. I talk about the 19th century, the Civil War, Reconstruction. And then I get into a discussion of Jim Crow and how that affected people politically, their diet. Talk about the Great Migration, where I trace both sides of my family, my mother's side from North Carolina, my father's side from Virginia, and what happened when my grandparents left their home communities and came up to New York. What happened to their eating? How did it affect? And then I take that kind of discussion all the way up to a chapter I call Eating Jim Crow. And what was it like as a black person to try to eat outside your house with Jim Crow politics affecting you?
Really, really. And Tina, let's talk a little bit about your grandmothers, I believe, who got you interested in baking. And what were some of the desserts and baked goods that you cooked as a child with them? Was it strictly sweet potato pie? Did you guys do anything that might be specific to your family? Any specialties?
Definitely. Now, the food, of course, was fantastic, but the dessert was my great-grandmother. She stuck to pretty much cake. And she was a domestic for many years.
Mm.
And, you know, in upper-class white person's home. And, you know, she would come home and prepare dinner for us. And so our treat for the week was always chocolate cake or pound cake. And she would make homemade apple pie. That was consistently, those were staples. You know, every week it was going to be one of those three. My maternal grandmother, she got more off into the Italian cream cakes, the red velvets, and the little pecan tart, and, you know, really, really good different desserts that she would make, and she was fabulous. And so that's where I really got the flair to do different types. The basics were taught by my great-grandmother, but my grandmother really, she stepped out there and did different things.
Well, let me ask you this, Tina. Have you thought about doing a book, like a cookbook, to pass the legacy on to your children and your children's children? Is that in the works?
I have not decided on the cookbook yet. I would gravitate more toward actually working with the young children directly and in small groups and having a baking class and or cooking, you know, because I do cook well also, but mostly baking so that we won't lose that with our kids.
Right, we have to pass it on.
Discussing with Leslie, yeah, we are in the age of convenience. Grown people walking around that couldn't tell you how to make a scratch cake. And I want kids to be able to learn. And they show interest because when I'm out selling, they are the ones that are, you know, the most interested in asking the most questions.
And, you know, it's really, and I'm sure even the professor can speak to the fact that, you know, generations ago we spent a lot of time in the kitchen. And we spent more quality time as families around the table. And, I mean, there's so much more that you learn when you're in the kitchen. I remember watching my grandfather strain coconut through cheesecloth to make rice pudding. He was from the West Indies. And you know, we've become such a fast-moving people and a people of convenience these days that we don't stop to smell the cookies, so to speak. We don't spend time in terms of that intergenerational piece that seems to be lacking in our modern society. Professor, would you like to speak with that? And then I'd like to pass that on to Tina as well.
I agree with you 100%. And, you know, one of the things that when you asked Tina about doing a cookbook, I certainly would encourage her to do that. And do a cookbook that's very much related to what she's learned from her grandparents. Because when it comes to African-American people and even African people, that, first of all, that food and recipes are a woman's domain. And it's how family history is passed down. It's usually the women who function as the griot, that is the storytellers. And when you look at, a recipe, it's not just about the production of a particular dish, whether it be a sweet dish or just a side that's served at Thanksgiving. Let me give you an example. There's a story of a woman who every time she served ham to the family on a holiday, the end of the ham was always cut off. And the daughter said, Mom, and, you know, the mother was now in her 70s, or I think like 60s, and the daughter was, you know, somewhere around 40. So, Mom, why do you cut off the ham before you serve it? And she said, well, that's how my mother taught me. And her mother was up into her 80s, but she called her mom. She said, ask Grandma, why did she teach you that? She called Grandma. Grandma said, well, you know, she said to her, why do I teach you to cut off the ham? She said, because as a child growing up, the stove that my grandmother had, and she lived with us and did all our cooking, was the ham was too big for the stove. So she cut it off before she put it in the oven. And that's why we passed on this tradition. You all just didn't know. You know, so often when you learn recipes, you're not just learning. You're learning a lot of the family history, where people came from, you know, the gardens that they grew, what they grew in their gardens, and why did a particular dish become our family dish. Because every family has something that identifies them, where they're from, and their only particular family history.
Right. Tina, why don't you share a little bit about the wisdom that was imparted beyond just your expert culinary skills by being in the kitchen with your ancestors and your relatives?
Gosh, it was all very practical, you know, because back then they didn't use measuring cups and measuring spoons. And a lot of things were done by sight. And to this day, I can look at a cake and tell you how it's going to come out of the oven.
Mm.
You know what it's going to be before it goes in. And it's the kind of things that you can't teach, but you have to be shown a lot of those things. But, even though I've had to actually figure out what the correct measurements was in baking with my grandparents, I never saw them pick up maybe a teaspoon, and it wasn't even a measuring spoon. It was one out of the drawer to put the vanilla in. And so it was just, it's amazing to see that.
Right.
But
and I'm sure that's even...
it was practical.
Yeah, and I'm sure the professor could speak that a little bit, because, you know, you hear a pinch of this and just
exactly.
A little bit of this and a whole lot of TLC. And, you know, I'm sure that there must be something lost in that translation because of the fact that, you know, some of our grandmoms and great-grandmoms didn't need to use measuring cups and measuring spoons when they cooked, because it was basically love that they were putting in whatever they made for us.
It is. You know, cooking for African-American people and people of African descent in general, It's a lot like jazz. You know, there's a certain bass line that you know, a certain note, but how you develop that, what you put in that, and how you give your own signature to that particular recipe like a song is what makes it distinct. And you're right, it's very hard to translate, you know, a handful of this, a thumbnail amount of this. And that's a lot of what the recipe, it's oral history. So you're passing on oral history from one person to the other. And there's some items that your parents or grandparents may have used that are no longer available in the store. So then you have to adapt to a new product or come up with something, you know, when you're cooking. So it's very much, to me, like jazz.
Right. And that almost makes me think of gumbo, where it's just a
mm-hmm.
mixture of different mm-hmm. ingredients, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But we got to ask Tina about the socket to me cake, because... As the professor suggested, soul food caused us all afros, okay, back through the civil rights movement. Nakatomi cake, I don't even know what that is, but it sounds like I want to have some. So let's talk about the Nakatomi cake.
Well, the Nakatomi cake, I've had one. It's not on my menu, believe it or not. It is not on my menu. But
what is it? What I want to know what it is.
Well, I know it has a little bit of cinnamon in it. It's like a coffee cake, got pecan, it's a very good cake. But I can't tell you that it's gonna be a standard cake that you're gonna see on a lot of people's menus, but I can give you an idea what's in it. If that'll help.
Okay.
And
okay.
Then you can decide when you wanna go buy one. It's it's like your pecan cinnamon. It's almost like coffee cake. It's like a strudel, and then you top it with a little icing.
Huh.
And you, it's like a coffee cake. It really is. But
Tina, where did the name come from?
Now, I can't tell you that.
No, I think I've heard of it before. In fact, Professor, I was going to ask you for the historical.
Don't get me lying, because
I'm not going to put you on the spot.
It's news to me. I love the name. I mean, see, things like that, I mean, to have that in a cookbook and a recipe on it, it may be something that, Tina, you know all about, but for me, that's the first time I've heard of it, and it sounds fascinating. You know, that Sakatumi cake, and it sounds straight up like Black Power to me.
Yeah, you know, and when we were talking a little bit earlier ago about healthy recipes, and, you know, something just came to mind, carrot cake.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's so popular these days. And, Tina, do you have a lot of requests for carrot cake?
I do.
And do you make a mean one?
Yes. That's TTG.
Okay, so we're
going to
call
that's
it
a pass-down recipe. That's
oh, really?
TTG carrot cake, and that's how it's stated on my menu. That's a pass-down recipe.
Wow.
That's very interesting. That's one of my favorite desserts. And, again, I would suspect that that is a fairly healthy dessert alternative, correct?
Well, it's not. It does not have – it has about the same amount of sugar as any other cake. But you have carrots in it and, you know, walnuts. And so, I mean, if you really want to cheat and say, you know, I ate some vegetables today,
Another
southern cake that
you
have not mentioned is the hummingbird cake. The which
one?
Hummingbird.
Yeah. No, so you got me on that one, too.
Me, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, that's why she has to write the book. You know, listen, I want you, Professor, to collaborate with her on a cookbook. And then another suggestion by Leslie was that you need to do some type of virtual baking class of baking school or some type of video showing people how to bake. Because, you know, one of the things that's also becoming a lot more prevalent in our society is that people aren't reading as much. They simply just, you know, like to watch, you know, whether it's exercise or what have you. We've become such a visual people. And so we have to leverage that and create some type of, you know, movie about or videos about how to cook.
Absolutely.
This is true.
Well, come on, don't leave me hanging. I need to learn more about this. What'd you call the what kind of cake?
Hummingbird cake.
Hummingbird cake. And this cake is, I get a lot of people who've never heard of it, but it is definitely a southern sweet. It is made with bananas, pineapples, two kinds of nuts, cinnamon, and cream cheese icing.
And it's interesting that you would incorporate the pineapple because that's typically not a African-American staple.
Exactly, it's not. However,
I think one of your ancestors went to Hawaii
staple.
Or something.
It's an island staple.
Yeah, I think one of your ancestors made a trip to Hawaii and
Well, I mean, but we do upside-down pineapple cake, don't we do that?
That's true. That's very, very true.
Oh, yeah, we do upside-down pineapple cake all day. I just put one on Facebook.
Tina, now, do you work out of your own house, or do you have a commercial space that you use for your baking?
A little bit of both. For now, I use a caterer's facility.
Mm-hmm.
And for, you know, something small, I can just whip it up in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I do both.
Mm-hmm. And Leslie's getting me hungry here by whispering all these wonderful foods like cobblers in my ear. Cobblers must be very, very popular down south.
They are. And Leslie, talk about some cobbler. I stick to fruit pies, but cobblers are second in line. I've even tasted it. It has not made it because this woman was phenomenal. She's an older lady. Made a sweet potato cobbler.
No, I've never heard of that. Wow.
I've never heard of that either.
It was like a party in your mouth. You wouldn't believe it. It's sweet potato yams inside a cobbler with the juice and everything. It was crazy.
Wow.
Wow.
And she was an older lady.
And then I got one for you guys. How about an Obama cake? And we're going to call it a black and white cake, but we're going to call it the Obama cake.
That's a new one on me, too. now, the sweet potato cobbler, did you get the recipe from this person? Because, see, that needs to be in your book. That should be in your recipe book.
Yeah.
It should be. I need to hunt down. It was one of my best friend's church members. And I kept telling her, who is this woman? Because she would bring this stuff home. And I'm like, well, who is this woman that makes this cobbler? I will pay for one of these cobblers.
Mm-hmm.
But she would only make it for church people. So I will see if this woman is even still here with us in this realm, because she was very elderly.
See, that's what I mean by, I mean, that to me is an example of black intellectual property. You know,
right.
you got to keep it. It's got to be passed on to the next generation.
That's
and
right.
If it's not recorded, we lose it.
That's right. And we're losing it already. I mean, we're becoming so diluted. It's becoming so diluted because the older our relatives get, the more they lose. And they're not going to remember how to make it by the time they get to 90, God willing. Okay,
yeah.
So we have to capture it and pass it on.
Well, yeah, think about how young the grandmothers are now. Some of them don't even have it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the other sad reality, and actually it could be a benefit if you really consider doing the book, is that, again, a lot of our young women specifically don't know how to bake because they were never told. And because of the fragmentation, if you will, of the intergenerational thing that was so strong in our culture.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Professor, you could probably speak to that a little bit.
No, it's true. We have a situation where, you know, a lot of us have lost this thing. And also, too, some of it is, for example, parents who are, you know, like, you know, maybe in their, now they're in their 60s or 70s and their kids are grown, who grew up as domestics, like my grandparents, both of them grew up as domestics, working for white folks. And the association with cooking became associated with something that's demeaning and labor that I don't want my kids to do. And so we don't pass on that ability and that skill of cooking because we saw it as something that was made us less than white folks. And so a lot of times, you're right, the next generation is not picking it up.
Mm.
Right.
And according
exactly.
to Leslie, the Obama cake is a chocolate upside-down pineapple cake. I thought there had to be some white flour in there, too.
Oh, wow.
You know, this has been a very sweet show, no pun intended. I appreciate the fact that we were able to get you on the phone with us, Professor. And I really think that you guys should stay in touch and consider some type of joint venture where we can capture the history and the quality of our African-American sweet tooth and baked goods. And if there's anything I can do to support that, by all means, let me know. My background's in marketing and business development. So we do need to stay in touch. What I'd like you to do, Tina, before you go, and I'm going to ask the same with you, Professor, let's give people how they can get more information about the wonderful works that represent what you do. And, Tina, you go first.
Okay. My phone number is 678-663-3088.
Okay, and the website again, please?
My web address is www.toothesweet.biz.
Okay, and do you business with any local restaurants in the Atlanta area in case people wanted to get a taste of your sweet baked goods, your sweets and baked goods?
I have, actually. My banana puddings were featured in a local seafood restaurant just for this weekend only, but I don't have a long-standing contract with any restaurant today right now.
We're going to get you some. I'm sure there's some restaurateurs listening to the show, so we'll get you some in the future. Professor, share with people your book, where they can buy the book from and learn more about the wonderful works that you do.
There's links to my book on my food blog, which I post every day, and the address is simply HTTP, and then your basic Frederick Douglass Opie, one word, Frederick Douglass Opie with two S's, .blogspot.com. So, and you could also just Google, the name of the website is actually Hog and Hominy Culture, Cooking, and Travel. If you just Google that or did Frederick Douglass Opie, .blogspot.com, you could find me. You could also befriend me on Facebook. I do the blog, and then I also download it on Facebook, and I also have a Twitter site, The Twitter site is also pretty easy to remember. It's Dr. Fred D. Opie. Dr. Fred D. Opie. And again, that's another place where I do a link to the blog. And on the blog, there's information about the book, Hog and Hominy.
Okay. And on Facebook, you're Professor Obie?
Opie. O-P-I-E. So on Facebook, it's just, Facebook is.
I'm going to look you up right now. And we know we have Tina's information, so we can definitely make sure that, the fruitcake is in the mail sometime around Christmas. just be careful with the brandy, okay? Because I just knocked out an entire job of Grandma's fruitcake, and that's for another show. Thank you all for being a part of a wonderful, wonderful show. You've been listening to the Gist of Freedom is Faith show with our executive producer, Leslie Gist Etheridge, and we'll look forward to talking with you and our big family of a listening audience next Sunday night. Thank you. God bless.
Bye-bye.
Thank you both. Thank you. Bye-bye.